welcome to episode 59 of our podcast, Two Chairs Talking. My name is David Grigg, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, the thoroughly informed Perry Middlemiss. What do you know, Perry?
Not a lot, David. What a good start, really. When you think about it. No, that's okay. Look, thoroughly informed. No, that's all right. It's just a bit of a shock to think that anybody thinks that I'm thoroughly informed about anything.
Well, you know about the Hugos and things.
Oh, yeah, but, you know, it's just a little bit of reading around the place and know a little bit more about things because I've got a subscription to Locus magazine, which I can, again, heartily recommend to everybody out there. And I also read the File 770 website, which is Mike Glyer's newsletter for the science fiction and fantasy fanish world, if you like. So he covers quite a lot of material that is also covered by Locus, but he covers a lot that isn't. So he will deal with things that are a bit more specific about fanish politics, fanish things that are going on, ports on conventions, publishing, who's doing what, that sort of thing. And you can find him fairly easily under on the website, file770, and they're all numbers.com. We'll put a link in the show notes.
Yep.
It used to be a paper-based newsletter, but of course, the way the world is these days and the cost of postage, my God, is that expensive, especially outside of Australia. Hell's bells. And the fact that, of course, there's all this problem with the US Postal Service. So things are, from which we've heard from Bruce Gillespie, where fanzines are being sent at the lovely rate of about $12 to $15 postage per pop and are bouncing back from the US Postal Service because they don't accept it for some reason or other, although they never tell you why. And so it's causing him a lot of angst, as you can understand, because not only is it expensive, it also basically just messes up his publishing and how does he get it to people? And, you know, he's also got the problem with his fanzine science fiction commentary, which has been running for 50 years, that his preferred printer has gone out of business due to the pandemic. And so he's in a bit of a bind. He can't go anywhere because of the current lockdown to try and find somebody, and he can't print anything. And then when he posts it, he can't post it. So, or he can, but half the time he's going to bounce from the US. So he's not a happy boy, and I can understand it. And that's why so many of us now have moved over to just electronic only.
Sure.
David, as you're aware. So It's all a bit unfortunate, but there we go. Don't know much else other than that, though. Oh, yeah, I was just going to say that I do have one award to talk about.
No, tell me about the award.
All right, okay. Well, the award that I wanted to talk about this week, and I know that you've got something to cover a little bit later, the one that I want to talk about is the Cord Wainer-Smith Rediscovery Award.
Ah.
Now, if you thought that the SF and fantasy genre had massive amounts of awards, you've got no idea how many there are. This is one that has been around for about the last 20-odd years, and as the title suggests, it is a rediscovery award. That is, it is an award that is made to people who the organisers of the award don't really feel have received enough recognition in their time or have been maybe forgotten. Started off in 2001 by giving it to Olaf Stapleton, who we might know from the 30s and 40s as a British writer who wrote First and Last Men and
Star Maker,
that's right. And then it went through R.A. Lafferty, Edgar Pangborn, Henry Kuttner, C.L. Moore, Lee Brackett, onwards to Frederick Brown.
Yes.
Who I wouldn't have thought had been forgotten, but maybe these days he has.
Yeah.
Wyman Gwyn, who I know about, can't ever say that I've read. Judith Merrill, who I don't think has been forgotten about, but then again, maybe. Carol Emshwiller. And this year, the award's been given to D.G. Compton.
Oh, yes, fair enough, too.
I know of D.G. Compton, but I can't actually put my finger on anything that I've actually read.
I had a phase when I was reading quite a few of his things, The Continuous Catherine Mortenhoe.
Yep, that was filmed as Death Watch by Bertrand Tavernier in 1979. He also was nominated for a Nebula Award for The Steel Crocodile for his 19, that was a 1970 novel, and his 1980 novel Ascendancies was on the.
One other I'm trying to think of that I read that there, I think there's a group of people who are on Mars, something like that. I've forgotten
Maybe.
now what it's called. I could look it up, but I'll look it up before the end of the show.
Anyway, I sort of thought that he was sort of around at that time. It was sort of, late New Worlds leading into Christopher Priest stuff starting in the mid-late 70s. And he was, to me, he was always one of those people that sort of filled that gap between the 60s and the later 70s and 80s stuff. So he's much more in the 70s. And I've probably got three or four of his books on the shelf. Just haven't read them.
Farewell Earth's Bliss, that was the one I was thinking of. Farewell
Okay.
Earth's Bliss, and there's a group of people who are stranded on Mars. I can't remember now the details, a long time ago. But I do remember the continuous Catherine Mortenhoe, which was an excellent book. But he wrote a lot by the look of it, yeah.
Well, I think he probably did, but again, I was just. I'm just. It's just one of those authors. He's one of those authors in the field that I know the name of, but I can't actually sit down and say I have absolutely definitely read anything by
Sure.
them.
Oh, well, that's quite
You have,
reasonable
but
to
yeah.
pick him for this sort of thing then. Yeah, he has
Yep,
been lightly
absolutely.
forgotten. Yeah, sure. I was going to mention, last time we talked about the Ned Kelly Awards, the Crime Awards, Australian Award for Best Crime Fiction. I thought it probably worth mentioning the Davitt Award, which is given by the Sisters in Crime Australia for female crime writers. And there's a couple of the people on that list, a couple of the books on that list are also on the Ned Kelly list, which is, I guess, not surprising. I actually thought there might be more, but nevertheless, so I'll just quickly run through the list of nominees. The actual award is given, I think, on the 28th of August, so not very long from now. So if you want to read any of these that you haven't read so far, you have to do it in a heck of a hurry. So the list is Death Beyond the Limit by B.M. Allsop, Dead Man's Track by Sarah Barry, Gathering Dark by Candice Fox, which is also on the Ned Kelly list, A Testament of Character by Solari Gentile, which is also on the Ned Kelly list, The Good Sister by Sally Hepworth, Where the Truth Lies by Karina Kilmore, The Deceptions by Suzanne Leal, Stone Sky Gold Mountain by Mirandi Riwau, Riwoe, I don't know how to pronounce that, Torched by Kimberly Starr. So that's their list for the Davitt Award.
So this is for best crime
Written by a
fiction,
woman, yeah.
written by a woman in
In
Australia.
Australia, yeah.
That's quite a long short list.
Yeah, it is. What's that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Yeah, 9.
The one thing I like about some of the awards in the SF field is that they do actually give you enough time to actually read the things beforehand. This is one of the things I find a little bit difficult with the Neds, for example, that you don't really, you've just got to drop everything. If you want to get through them, unless you've been lucky enough to be able to pick, say, half the list before the awards announced, you're just not going to make it, which is a bit disappointing because it's sometimes good to go along to an award or be there when the award is going to be announced. Like this year, they'll obviously be online because it looks like our current lockdown is going to go past the 28th of August. It would be interesting to be able to sit there and knowing that you've read everything and be able to cheer or jeer depending on what the result
Well,
is.
the result is yes, yeah.
So the difference between those awards which don't give you enough time in the Hugos, especially this year, David, is that we've got massive amounts of time in which to read all of the works that have been nominated. And normally we'd be coming up to the announcement of the Hugo Awards, but this year, because of the change in the date of the Worldcon, it's been pushed back to, well, probably you've got up until sometime late November to put the votes in. So we've got plenty of time to actually read the stuff, which is good, which is good.
Which is good.
And speaking of which, we decided this week, as we said last week, that we would be talking about the novelettes that are on this year's Hugo ballot. Now, although I keep pounding on about this, it is good to remind people that the novelette is short fiction that fits between 7,500 and 17,000 15,500 words. So it's sort of like a long short story or a short long story. It's one of those weird ones that fits in the middle, and we shall have a bit of a chat about what that means for the stories that have been nominated this year. So I thought I would start, David, that's okay. And I'm going to start with the first one that I was going to have a talk about, which is called The Pill by Meg Ellison. This was originally published in her collection Big Girl, and there's a hint right there for you. So anyway, bit of an introduction to Meg Ellison. She's the winner. She was the winner of the 2015 Philip K. Dick Award for a novel, The Book of the Unnamed Midwife, which I really enjoyed. It was part of a series, first part of a series, which I haven't got to finish the rest of them, but I should, because I enjoyed that quite a lot. And she's been previously nominated for the Otherwise Award, which was previously known as the James Tiptree Jr. Award. Mm-hmm. Now, this nominate, The Pill, was also nominated for the 2021 Nebula Award and the Theodore Sturgeon Memorial Award. That last award hasn't been handed out yet, I don't think. Anyway, it didn't win the Nebula for the best novelette, but there we go. Anyway, the main character of this award, Munchkin, the words that I'm going to use here are specifically chosen so that people don't think, oh no, he's being really, you know, prejudicial about this. These are the words that are used in the story. So don't think that I'm making this up and being, you know, overly critical. These are just the words that she uses. So Munchkin is a fat woman who comes from a family of fat people. All of them are very fat. And she talks to them as fat, about this being fat. Now, her mother is continually on the lookout for a magic bullet to solve this problem, a treatment that will cure the whole family of all their fatness for good. And she tries diets and treatments and exercise and pills and anything that doesn't have a faintest promise of actually working. None of it does, of course. It all basically just goes round and round in a typical cycle of trying the diets, trying the treatments, and then coming back onto and keeping the weight back on. She might lose a bit for a while, but gets it back on. Anyway, finally, Munchkin's mother is offered a place in the clinical trial of the pill, capital T, capital pill of the title, because that's all it's referred to in this, is the pill. Now, she takes it, and it acts fairly violently on her because it forces her to defecate vast amounts of fat from her body on a regular basis. Now, this process is not really very nice because while it's effective, it's incredibly painful. I mean, she's losing something in the vicinity of 40 to 50 pounds worth of fat per excretion, if you like. So this is just a phenomenal amount of stuff. But it does result in the end where her mother becomes very thin and very beautiful. So everything seems to be hunky-dory. Everything's great. As this goes on, the pill passes its trial, but it has an unfortunate side effect of killing 1 in 10 people who use it. 10% of the people who use this pill don't actually make it through the whole process. But the demands for its access are so great and so much pressure is put on people, on the authorities, that it's approved, and it gradually begins to change the face of society. That a lot of people start taking it, a lot of people start getting thin, and they stay thin after they've taken this and stay beautiful. In the family, Munchkin's father tries it, but he dies during the treatment. But her brother does survive, and then the pressure starts to build on Munchkin herself to follow the rest of the family and actually take this particular pill. But she fights against that, and the novelette talks about her journey to not take this particular pill and what happens to her as it goes through. Now, this is an interesting story about the pressure to conform to societal and familial pressures and the effects on society and modern life after the introduction of a new medical technology. So that part of things is very interesting. Travelers' main aim for this novel is pretty obvious right from the beginning, and it tends to diminish the impact the story might have. And so it's sort of not quite where you would want this to go. It needed to be, I don't know, how could I say? It just doesn't have the impact that I thought that it might have as it was going through. I was waiting for something to happen, and it just to me just seems fairly obvious all the way right through. David, what do you think?
I didn't think much of it really either. It's basically a think piece, which is fine. You know, sort of puts out some thoughts and things to think about. But I didn't really find it very engaging as a story. And the other thing is that really you're being told about what's happening rather than actually seeing it most of the time. So it's that kind of sort of passive sort of think piece sort of story. So yeah, I didn't like it much. No. All right, well, I'll go on to the first one I'll talk about, which is Helicopter Story. And this is by Isabel Fall. Now, this is yet another case, I think, where I've got to begin by recognizing and trying to balance my white heterosexual male privilege, because the very start of this story seems designed to challenge that. It starts with an author's note. Now, personally, I would have thought that a good story should speak for itself and not require an explanation from the author. But anyway, here we go. Here's the quote of the author's note. This is a story about the pinkwashing of imperialism and the need for queerness to constantly challenge the powers that want to capture and use us. Fair enough. But having started with that statement, I think this story utterly fails to deliver on that premise. So the first line of the actual story is, I sexually identify as an attack helicopter. Okay. But the very next sentence contradicts that. I lied. According to US Army Technical Manual Zero, the soldier as a system, attack helicopter is a gender identity, not a biological sex. Right. Okay, now, I'm really trying hard here to be sincerely respectful of those with non-binary gender. And I do respect them. But we don't have any guidance about what pronouns to use for someone whose gender is attack helicopter. So I'm going to use she and her, okay, in this discussion. Okay, don't email me. So the story is ostensibly about how the military has subverted and weaponized gender the way that they've weaponized many other facets of humanity. And I think that could have made it an interesting story, but this is not that story. Now, the protagonist is biologically of the female sex. She tells us that my body is an XX karyotype somatic female, and she once identified as a woman. But now she's an attack helicopter, she says. Though for all I can tell from the story, she's physically still human. She's really just, as far as I can see, just a pilot who's deeply integrated into the helicopter's control system. And there are some admittedly interesting passages in there about how she uses her past experiences as a woman in this military role. Setting all that aside, the story is basically that of a military mission to bomb a school inside a breakaway republic in North America. This republic is called the Per Mesa Budget Committee, because that's apparently how it started out, as a credit union gone rogue. It's mostly controlled by the computers of that credit union, which have now become an artificial intelligence. So the mission is perilous, but they dodge radars and reach the school. Now, the name of the woman / helicopter is Barb. So Barb orders her weapons specialist, Axis, to attack the school with these thermic missiles. But Axis hesitates, and Barb has to issue the command again, after which she does fire, and the school is destroyed, burnt to the ground. And later they discuss his hesitation, his lack of commitment to the mission. But there's not much time for that, because they're targeted by fighter planes from the Per Mesa Budget Committee. The aircraft is damaged and barely able to limp back to base. And that's the story. So, look, I'll frankly admit that I didn't understand its take on gender and queerness. All I can say is that those aspects seem to me to be very superficially tacked on to a simple story in a way which didn't really clarify anything. So, again, one of these stories which is just not for me, I think. But, I didn't think a lot of it. There you go. What did you think, Perry?
About the same. I had no idea what it was trying to achieve, really. I couldn't work it out. Is it trying to say that all genders are fluid and that they all should be represented and respected? Well, yeah, I don't have a problem with any of that. I don't see... Anyway, I just don't know. It just seemed to me that it was trying to tell me something that I just couldn't get.
Yes, this weaponizing of gender identity, which I didn't see that in it, you know. That was not there to me.
Well, you may not be aware of the fact that, because some of this got lost, as this was originally published January 2020, so it's like 18 months ago.
Right.
Now, this isn't the original title for the book. The original title for the book is I Sexually Identify as an Attack Helicopter, namely the first sentence that you mentioned. But the author changed the title after an inordinate amount of attacks on her in this story, especially as the original title co-opts a transphobic meme. Now, I wasn't aware of that. I mean, I'm not across the transphobia, so I don't know. I don't take any notice of them, so I don't recognise some of the insults that they hurl around. Now, and I can't work out why she would use this, other than to say maybe that she's just assumed that meme as a means of subverting it somehow.
Okay, that makes a bit more sense.
If that's the case, does she succeed?
I didn't think so.
I don't know what she was trying to do. I mean, okay, I can understand that if you want to pick up on something and like this and try and subvert it, yes, that's quite acceptable and quite reasonable. And I would applaud that you would try to do something like that. I just don't think she's achieved it.
No.
I didn't know what she was going to do.
No.
The difficulty that you've got here is that Isabel Fall's first story, and she's just disappeared.
No.
There was so much. She was in the middle of, I believe, from what I've read, she was in the middle of transitioning and has given up this identity now and gone back to her previous identity to hide.
So
this is very sad that this thing has come to this this extent, that basically people are giving authors such a hard time over what they've written. Because politicising all fiction. I suppose in this instance, though, that if you're going to try and subvert a transphobic meme, that you are politicising it anyway, and that you are going to be open yourself up for criticism. Anyway.
No, that sort of at least explains a bit that I makes it a little bit easier to understand what she might have been trying to do. But, yeah, I agree. I don't think she makes it with it. Anyway.
All right. My next one is... the title of this is Burn, or the Episodic Life of Sam Wells as a Super. This is written by A.T. Greenblatt. Now, Greenblatt's been nominated for the Nebula Award 3 times for 1 win, and this is her first Hugo nomination. It's also been nominated for the 2021 Locus Award, didn't win it, and the 2021 Nebula Award, didn't win that either. So, but it was up for, it's been nominated, so, you know, nominations are good. Depends on whether the story's any good, though.
Yeah.
This is what it all comes down to. Now, the lead character, as you guess from the title, is named Sam Wells. Sam Wells lives in a world where some people discover that they have superpowers, but they only discover them in their mid-20s. And as the story starts, Sam's powers, that is the ability to set himself on fire and survive, have just started to develop. So basically his hands go on fire and his head goes on fire, which has burnt all his hair off. So anyway, he longs to become a member of this sort of group called the Supers, who are a group of super-powered people who fight crime and rescue people, you know, sort of like the standard sort of comic book superpower groups that you get. But because he doesn't have much control over his flames, he can bring them on, but he can't really utilize them very much other than just stand there and burn, which is not really overly effective or productive. And as a result, though, he applies to join the group and is accepted into this group, though only in the position that utilizes his existing accountancy skills. And this is more so that the group can keep an eye on him rather than have him running around and, you know, be out of control. So they bring all these supers in and put them in the group so that they can sort of integrate. So Sam, who's generally not terribly good at making friends with people, gradually integrates himself into the group and then sort of gets to know everybody. And then finally one day he learns how to actually use his power for the good of others, although it's not necessarily as he first thought and first expected. This is as much a coming-of-age or wish-fulfillment story as anything else. It's competently written and engaging, but it doesn't really stay in the mind for very long. And it was like, yeah, okay. That's about all I got for it, really. Just, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That's it. I don't know what else to say.
No, there's very little to say about it, I think. I mean, it's... As you say, the interest really is this human interest story, that his character arc of, as you say, almost coming of age and changing from being the scorned outsider to being someone accepted as part of the team. But yeah, I don't think you really needed a background of superheroes to tell that sort of story. My notes say, as it is, it's kind of a very low-energy version of an X-Man comic book.
Yeah, okay.
Probably quite right. Yeah. All right. So what have I got next on my list? This one, yeah. This is called The Inaccessibility of Heaven by Elliot de Bodard. And I thought this had an interesting concept, at least. It's set in a city called Star Hollow. And other than that sort of slightly fantastical name, the place itself seems to be very similar to a fairly normal, you know, American city of today. But as well as human beings living in the city, there's also a large population of displaced people, refugees, if you like. And these are the fallen, the fallen angels expelled from heaven due to their rebellion. And it turns out that there have been several such episodes of rebellion over the millennia, not just the one that we read about in Paradise Lost. So there's been several phases of this rebellion, and the fallen are now congregated in this city on Earth. Now, some of the humans in Star Hollow are also witches, and the first-person protagonist, Sam De Vieira, is one of these witches. And she works with a fallen angel called Cal at an agency which is trying to protect the fallen from body looters who want to kill the angels to use their bodies for various purposes. It turns out that the bones of angels can apparently be used as drugs, and there's a thriving black market in them. Now, Sam is very close to her partner, Cal. It's not quite clear if they're actually lovers, but they have a very close friendship anyway, which goes beyond their working partnership. As the story opens, Sam is forcibly taken from her apartment to see the boss of a crime syndicate, Ardivai, who is himself one of the fallen. And he wants her help because there seems to be a killing spree going on and connected with the body looters. Certain fallen angels have been targeted and parts of their bodies removed. Sam reluctantly agrees to help Ardivai, but she doesn't really trust him. And while she's talking to Ardivai, her partner, the angel Cal, arrives. Cal is angry and dismissive and tells Sam coldly that it's none of her business. Stay out of it, which is a real change in their usual friendly relationship. Anyway, the plot thickens, and despite Cal's warnings, Sam eventually uncovers evidence of what's been going on. The angels are being killed so that their body parts can be used in an audacious attempt to open a portal into the heavenly city through which a group of the rebel angels can return. And in the process of discovering all this, Sam also learns things about Cal which are very unwelcome to her. Look, I didn't mind the story. I thought it had an interesting premise, and the plot's interesting. It's basically a kind of noir detective story with a couple of interesting plot twists I didn't see coming. And the build-up and maintenance of tensions handled well. The characters well-defined, interesting. So, yeah, I gave this one, you know, points. I thought it was not too bad. What did you think, Perry?
Well, the interesting thing about this is that it seems to be an alternate version of a series that this author has written a number of stories in already, which is referred to as the Dominion of the Fallen series. Now, that's set in Paris, which has been fairly heavily destroyed. Maybe it's the same universe, but this is set somewhere else outside Paris. I'm not sure. I don't know. Mm. It seemed to be an American city, but
it felt like an American city.
Yeah. Sometimes you can't tell. The Fallen series, there's three major novels in it: House of Shattered Wings, The House of Binding Thorns, and The House of Sundering Flames, plus another number of shorter works. And so I was thinking that it was sort of going to fit into that when I started talking about it, but it does seem to be a little bit off to the side. There seems also to be a lot of background material here that's hinted at but doesn't really get described. Seems like there's been a lot going on around the edges with the act of the fall and how the fallen have, well, integrated and then sort of in some ways taken over parts of the human society that you don't really get much of a view about. And it's got a bit of a really swift, odd ending to it, which I wasn't overly considered. And I get left with the sense that not enough had been delivered really, in the story for it to carry through. I mean, I really like Elliot de Bodard's stuff. I just, you know, I thought, yeah, I thought it was okay, but not much more than that, really. I should note that this has also been nominated for the 2021 Locust Award for Best Novelette. And de Bodard, to give you an idea, has been nominated 8 times for the Hugo Award, 8 times.
Right.
7 times for the Nebula Award for 3 wins, and she's also won a British Fantasy Award, 4 British SF Association Awards, and a Locus Award.
Okay.
She's a writer of Vietnamese background who lives in Paris.
Oh, there you go.
And as I said, The Fallen is not my favourite stuff of hers. She's got another sort of space opera series, which I really quite like. And it depicts a sort of Asian empire with a lot of Vietnamese overtones in space. And some of those are very interesting. Some of those that have been nominated for the Hugo Awards, but she hasn't been picking up enough wins for those, unfortunately. But there we go.
No, there you go.
So look, I think she's a very interesting writer to watch. I just didn't think this was one of her best. This is one that I think might have gone on a little bit longer. I think that if it had been pushed out to novella length, it might have been better because it would have filled in a bit more of the background for people. But there we go.
Yeah.
Anyway, so now I'm going to move to Two Truths and a Lie by Sarah Pinsker. And this is a story which I think is perfect for this particular length. I think this is one of the few that's on this ballot that fitted the length on which it appears. I think a number of them, like the previous one that I was talking about, could well have done with more background material melded into the story to give you more of an idea of what was going on. This one doesn't need it, and I think this one works really quite well. Anyway, tell you the story about it. Stella, main character of this particular story, I don't think we ever hear her last name, but anyway, Stella has returned to her hometown to visiting her aging parents when she hears that Denny, the brother of her old friend Marco, has died. Now, Stella's moved away and has lost track with all of her old friends in this particular town. And so as a chance to reconnect with Marco and with her past, she attends the funeral of Denny and then offers to help Marco clear out Denny's house. Now, the difficulty here is that the house is a hoarder's dream. It is packed to the gunnels with boxes. There's boxes and junk and stuff everywhere, all over the place. So the two start meet one day and decide they're going to basically get into it and start clearing everything out after they can get through the front door, which is a bit of a struggle. I would have thought that you'd clear out the corridor, really, because if you're going to take stuff outside, you don't want to have to be fighting the front door. But anyway, they don't do that, so there's neither here nor there. As the two clean out the dining room, which is their first bit, and then the recreation room afterwards, they find boxes of old VHS videotapes. Now, some of these tapes contain recordings of an old local television program called The Uncle Bob Show. This was a children's program that mainly consisted of a man called Uncle Bob sitting in a chair telling stories to local children who played on the floor in front of him and who made up the audience. Now, Marco tells Stella that Denny was a frequent visitor to this particular program and that he would have appeared in a number of the videotapes. So they decide that while they're cleaning up Denny's stuff, that they'll have the videotapes running in the background as a sort of background material, and they can sort of possibly see him from time to time, and they'll remember him as they go. So they do that, and they'll follow through, and they look at it, and it's all helpful. And they get through the end of the day, and Stella decides that she goes home. The place stunk to high heaven, so she just throws her old clothes out. And she's staying with her parents, so she goes and sits on the front veranda with them and starts having a bit of a chat about what happened during the day and what was there. And her mother, Stella tells her mother about the Uncle Bob show. And her mother tells Stella that Stella, also used to go to that particular program and was there on a number of occasions. And the parents loved it because they could sit around and not have to worry about the kids. It was like a play group that they were just all sitting there over there. The parents could sit in the background, have a chat and just watch them, and the kids were fine. And the parents had half an hour or an hour all to themselves, which they thought was absolutely wonderful. Stella has no memory of this at all and finds it a bit strange. I decided to investigate further and was able to access the recordings of the program at the local television station. She also remembers one of the particular shows that Denny was on, where Uncle Bob was telling a story and looking directly at Denny while he was telling this particular story about an older brother with a younger brother who did everything to look after his younger brother and so on. And Denny sits up from what he was playing with and looks at Uncle Bob and says, "No," and stands up and walks out of the studio. Uncle Bob watches him go, but then just keeps on talking. Now, this sort of bemuses Stella a bit, and she decides that she wants to start looking at her appearances on the program. So she goes to the local television station. They track down the relevant tapes, and they start looking at them. And she comes across the episode, the major episode that she was in, and she slowly starts to remember what happened. And that leads her to discover things about herself that she never realised, and which help explain why she acts the way that she does. Now, I don't want to give away the ending of this because I think it's quite good. I really enjoyed this. It's a light piece of work until the end. You know, you think, oh, this is ticking along all right, and suddenly it sort of starts going a little bit dark near the end. But I really enjoyed this story. I thought that it, as I said earlier, I think it was conceived of and written to the length as it appears. It doesn't give me the impression it's been cut down from anything else, nor that it has been built up from a shorter story, which some of them are. It's got an actual beginning, a middle, and an end. And in tone, it reminds me of Geoffrey Ford's work. If you haven't read anything of Geoffrey Ford's, I can recommend his stuff to you. It's a bit obscure, and not a lot of people like it. The ones that do read his work really do like it. He doesn't write very much, but when he does, he produces some really excellent work. So what did you think of this one, David?
Well, I didn't like it anywhere near as much as you did. The problem with me is that you, just to fill in a bit that you didn't really talk about, is that these stories that Uncle Bob tells on this show are all really quite creepy. They actually freak out Stella when she hears some of these stories again. And he seems to target individual children and tells them stories, not directly about themselves, but which indicate some characteristic that they may have as they grow up. And it seems to actually have that influence. He tells the story, for example, he tells the story about a young boy who loves to run around and go very fast and likes to speed on his bike and so on. And the particular child he's targeting with this grows up and then loves to drive at high speed in his car and has a terrible car accident and is killed in the car accident. And there's a number of instances of that kind of thing where Bob tells this story which influences the child. And indeed, the story he tells about Stella, well, you mentioned the one about Denny, but the one about Stella influences her because it's a story about a little girl who didn't know who she was and who therefore starts to tell lies. And so one of the key parts of the story is the fact that Stella compulsively tells lies about her background. Like she tells Marco that she has a child, which she doesn't. Mm-hmm. So towards the end of the story, she really starts to lose track of what is true and what isn't true, just like the story that Uncle Bob told. But what I didn't like was the fact that you get to the end of the thing and she kind of goes in search of Uncle Bob and finds this empty house and finds the hill behind the house. I won't give it totally away. But it just seems to drop the ball for me that you never do find out who Uncle Bob was, why he used to tell these kind of stories, what the effect was, you know, why it had the effect that it did on children. So it just seems to me to be left up in the air. So no, I didn't actually like it very much.
I wasn't overly fussed. I didn't find out who Uncle Bob was. He's just the device in the story.
Okay. So, I need more than that, I think. I need some kind of rationale.
Okay. Anyway, look, this novelette won the 2021 Nebula Award for Best Novelette. See?
I got some taste.
It was also nominated for the Locus Award and has been nominated for the Bram Stoker Award. And the Bram Stoker Award is the horror award. So you can understand there's a bit of
It's kind of horror. Yeah. Anyway, no, it wasn't for me.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. So I'm the last one we're going to talk about, the last one on the list, is Monster by Naomi Kritzer. And this story starts with the protagonist, Cecily Grants, arriving in China. She's headed for Guizhou province. I'll never pronounce the Chinese words correctly, I'm sure, but I think it's Guizhou, something like that. She's headed for Guizhou province, which is a rural area where few tourists go. She doesn't speak Chinese, but she's relying on one of those translator apps on her smartphone. And she's told her friend Janine that she's going to this particular province in China because no one I know has ever been there. But in fact, as she tells us, that's a lie. She's going there to find someone called Andrew. And then the story is told in these interleaved passages of Cecily's travels through China, looking for Andrew, with flashbacks to her childhood where she made friends with this boy. Andrew was a nerdish kid who was bullied by others because he was a nerd. But he makes friends with her and he loans her books like William Gibson's Neuromancer and David Brin's Startide Rising. So they become close friends, but they don't become boyfriend and girlfriend. In fact, there's another girl, Nadine, who was Andrew's girlfriend, and she warns Cecily off, saying that Andrew likes to dissect animals at home, possibly having killed the animals himself. Nevertheless, Cecily remains friends with Andrew through school, though they lose contact after she goes to college. Andrew, apparently, although he's apparently brilliant, was never prepared to put in the hard work to get into a good college and ends up with going to some sort of, you know, second-class college. Cecily, however, dedicates herself to an interest in biochemistry and eventually earns a doctorate. She meets up again with Andrew after college, but it doesn't go well. He's very cold and distant to her. And then 20 years pass, they never get back in contact. But after 20 years, he does get back in contact and he asks her for a copy of the paper she's written on gene editing technology, which she innocently gives him. A few years after that, she's contacted by the FBI. It turns out that Andrew has been using her findings to conduct unauthorized research. He's been offering a home to runaway teenagers, but then experimenting on them without their consent. Many of the teenagers died or were left mentally damaged by this. And this was the stage where the FBI started to get involved and began to close in on Andrew. However, because of his research, Andrew has eventually come up with a potent serum, which gives him inhuman speed, reflexes and strength. And he breaks free from the armed officers sent to arrest him and he disappears. This is all just background you give. So now Dr. Cecily Grants is looking for Andrew in China. And she's actually acting for the FBI and CIA. They want her to bring Andrew back, and they want her to make him an offer of a safe return if he gives them the formula for his serum. But as it turns out, that's not what Cecily has in mind, .. So I won't give that away. I like the story a lot. This is probably, to me, the best of the bunch of novelettes in the Hugo ballot. That's what I would vote for. It's well-written and engaging. The characters are solid and interesting. The only thing I'd say against it is that I'm not sure that it's really SF. If you set aside the extreme powers that are claimed for Andrew's serum, which we never see demonstrated, it would work just as well as a straightforward thriller, I would have thought. Anyway, that's just me. But yeah, out of the six novelettes, this is the one I would choose. What do you think?
Yeah, I enjoyed it as a story. For me, it's second to Truths and a Lie. There's a lot that goes on in this particular story, and it's engaging. It tells some stories of two obsessions, really, sort of overlapping, but not with it doesn't come across as having an agenda right at the very start, which is very different from a lot of the other stories that we're dealing with here. And I think that the way those agendas is set is to the detriment of those stories, which is why this one basically tells a story and it works. And you can't ask for more than that. It was an enjoyable story to read.
I liked it.
So anyway, David, so that's the six. What would you've already told us that you go for Monster at number one. What would be your order? Going from top to bottom, Monster at number one, going down.
I've got to think about this now. Monster number one. Second one, I think I'd probably make The Inaccessibility of Heaven. The third one, Two Truths and a Lie. Where do we go after that? We start to go really down to the bottom, I think. They'll probably go burn, and then helicopter story, and then the pill right down the bottom, I think.
Okay, well, it looks like we have our top three the same, but not in the same order, and the bottom three the same, but also not the same order. Mm. So it looks like there was two completely separate groups here, which is interesting. So I went with Two Truths and a Lie, as I said, that I thought that was probably the best for me all the way through. Monster is the second one. Third, The Inaccessibility of Heaven. Four is Burn. Five, The Pill. And six, Helicopter Story.
Yeah. So we're largely in agreement, I think.
Largely in agreement. It's just slight variations in terms of which one we go for and what we think is probably going to be best at the top. But that's okay. Different strokes, as they say.
That's right.
So that was an interesting exercise, David. We have got the short stories to do, which we shall probably get to next episode.
Next episode.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's six of those and that, so we'll talk about those next time.
Indeed, that sounds good. So what else have you been reading?
What else have I been reading? I've, to get myself away from all this new stuff, I've been going back and look at some old stuff, as I do from time to time, and I've got one old crime novel and one old science fiction novel to read. I think I've told you, haven't I, that I've basically been going through my old paperbacks, reading through those, and once I've actually read them, I'm putting them out for donations to various charities, because sometimes I find I've got two copies of things. Don't know how that happened, but I do. I've got a collection of something that includes one of these novels. And anyway, so the first one of these is The Hound of the Baskervilles.
Oh, yes.
1902. My view, the best of the Sherlock Holmes novels by Doyle. This one actually appears to be conceived as a novel. I mean, some of the earlier ones, Study in Scarlet, for example, is episodic, and there's bits of it that actually don't make any bloody sense at all to me. Now, they feel like they're rather pieced together and aren't actually conceived as a full novel, but this one has enough mystery to carry it all the way right through, even though in the middle of this there's some stylistic choices which you go, really? Anyway, we'll get to those in a minute. But this is, so this is 1902, and if you've been following the Sherlock Holmes stories in sequence, you'll realise that this is the first appearance of Holmes after his reported death at the hands of Moriarty, though this particular story is set prior to that event, namely the death. Mm. So that's interesting. So it's theoretically, there was a lot. I think what happened was that Doyle had an idea for a story a legend of a hound on the moors down in Cornwall or Devon. And he didn't know what to do with it until he thought, well, actually, this is a story for Holmes and Watson. And he thought, but I've killed the poor bloke. What am I going to do? I'll write it as if we've just finished the manuscript after, so these little quirks that some of these authors have. Strange people, authors. Isn't that right, David?
Very, very strange.
Anyway, so to give you the story, Holmes is called in to investigate the death of Sir Charles Baskerville, who appears to have died from fright, possibly as a result of being pursued by the gigantic hound of family legend. He's on his big property, and he's died in the middle of the night. And it looks like, it's quite obviously, it looks like he's been running away from something, had a heart attack and dropped dead. Now, the heir to the estate is a man called Sir Henry Baskerville, who's the nephew. He arrives in London from Canada, where he shifted quite a long time ago, but is determined that he's going to take over the estate and the fortune and put the fortune to good use. Well, the fortune was made in South Africa, so there's always a bit dubious around that time, probably the use of indentured labour and all that sort of stuff, and it's probably Charles has got his comeuppance anyway, and he's died. There's all this money left over. And so Henry thinks that the best thing for him to do with it is to ensure that the estate is kept up to date, because it needs a lot of maintenance. So Henry arrives in Baskerville and he's met by a friend of the family who's a doctor from the town, who shows him around town. And that doctor has already been in touch with Holmes and asked him to investigate. As it happens, Sir Henry Baskerville has exactly the same idea, that he was going to actually go and talk to Sherlock Holmes, only to find out that his companion has already done so. But they both turn up and talk to Holmes and Watson, and Holmes, who's continually bored out of his brain because he doesn't have enough to do, decides that this sounds like a very, very interesting story. But he's got a lot of other things on, David, and he can't really see himself having the time to be able to go down to Devon. So he sends Watson with Henry Baskerville down to the estate and says, look, Watson's my eyes and ears anyway. He'll write up the reports about what happens. And I've got these other things to do back in London, and I'll just read the reports that Watson sends me, and then when needed, I'll come down there. And that's the way it goes. And so for about a good third of the book, Holmes isn't even in view anywhere, which is a bit odd. And you get these long descriptions of what's been going on in and around the town from Watson, which are all quite interesting and quite illuminating. But of course, look, I don't think anybody that's ever read any of the Holmes and Watson stories is going to basically say that they don't know the story of this. So I'm not giving anything away, given that it's 120 years old. So basically what the story is that Holmes has already been down there the whole time, and he's been down there in hiding in the village next a little bit over, because he wants to be able to see what's going on down there, because he has suspicions of a particular person that was following Henry Baskerville in London, who recognised him, that is Holmes, in London, and he doesn't want to be seen by this particular guy, and he thinks that he has something to do with it, and he thinks that he's down in and around Baskerville, so he wants to hide himself away. It's a very interesting story, this. I really quite like this. I mean, it's a sense of, you know, somebody attempting to take over the estate by scaring the hell out of everybody and using the supernatural overtones of this vicious and ferocious hound to scare everybody. And it was a great hit when it first came out and was first published, and it's really easy to see why that it's kept on staying that way. It's really quite an excellent book, and I must admit I really enjoyed it. But I'll just put one note in at this stage, David, that I'm really having trouble reading a lot of those old paperbacks. The one that I've got for The Hound of the Baskervilles is a good 50 years old, I would reckon. And the paper that those paperbacks then were printed on was a sort of a creamy colour with very small font size. That creamy colour paper has now turned sort of tanny brown, and the black print is starting to fade towards grey. Now, grey on tan brown is not my best contrast colours at all. And the only way that I can read this is to basically stick it under my wife's sewing fluorescent lamp to get as much light on this as I possibly can, because that's the only way that I can actually get to read it. In fact, I got about halfway through it and I thought, I can't read this book in this anymore. It's just taking me forever. So I had to go down and track down the hardback copy I have of his collected works and read that. So while I can say that I read the paperback, I'm lying a bit here. I've read the book, but I did not read it in the paperback edition because, frankly, I just couldn't do it. I couldn't read it. It was just, I was squinting so much it was putting me to sleep, even though I definitely wanted to read it. I just couldn't get there. But anyway, it's an excellent book. If you haven't read it for a while, I'm never going to read this again, I don't think. I don't think I'm going to have time. And so, but it's good to go back and have a look at it again.
It
makes you think, should go and see some of the film versions of this and see what they've done with it.
Some of them are good, some of them are pretty
terrible. Of them are good, some of them are just atrocious. But anyway, it's a good story. I like this one.
Well, if you want to read it again, there's one easy solution to this business with the old paperback, and that's you use an e-book, and it's available for free from Standard eBooks, because I produced it for Standard eBooks.
Oh, good man.
So that's the last time I read it, was when I was going through proofreading. There you go. All right. Well, my next book, my first book I'm going to talk about in recent reading is a non-fiction book called Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind by Yuval Noah Harari. Now, I confess I haven't actually quite finished this book yet. I'm only about two-thirds of the way through. But as it's a non-fiction book and not a novel, I think I've read enough to be able to talk about it. So I'll do that. So the author is Dr. Yuval Noah Harari, and he's got a doctorate in history from Oxford University, and he now lectures on world history at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. So this is a very different look at the development of humanity, starting right back about 6 million years ago when our branch of the evolutionary tree split off from the chimpanzees. And this is in a chapter headed cheekily, "An Animal of No Significance." There's no reason to think that we were anything special. He points out that at one point in time, our ancestors, the direct ancestors of the species we call Homo sapiens, shared the planet with maybe as many as a dozen different hominid species. And there's no particular reason why our branch prospered at the expense of the others. Just chance. He says that we tend to assume that having a large brain and being able to use tools and to develop complex social structures are huge advantages which would give us dominance. But he points out the undoubted fact, which there's no question about it, that we had all of these advantages for a full 2 million years, and we did very little with them during that enormous stretch of time. We were, as he says, solidly in the middle of the food chain. That is, we ate plants and smaller animals, but we were regularly being eaten by larger animals. He says that it was probably the eventual domestication of fire that allowed us to change from that steady state after 2 million years of having no greater technology than the stone hand axe. Now, Harari has a very interesting take on many aspects of our development. For example, he calls the agricultural revolution, which happened about 10,000 years ago, history's biggest fraud. This was the point at which most humans changed from existing as small groups of nomadic hunter-gatherers to settling down in small communities which were tending plants. He calls it a fraud because the lives of individual humans before this revolution were undoubtedly better in many, many respects than those of individual humans after the change. In fact, he goes so far as to say that it wasn't a matter of humans domesticating wheat, but rather that wheat domesticated humans. When you think about it, it makes sense, because after the agricultural revolution, wheat as a species was in a much better state in evolutionary terms. Far more copies of wheat DNA were out in the world than previously, and wheat was being looked after magnificently. It was tended, fed, you know, weeds removed, watered. Humans, by contrast, lived in individually much worse lives, spending now much of their lives doing the backbreaking work of planting, weeding, and carrying water to put on plants. Growing crops did mean that we could feed a larger number of humans in one place, but as the population in such places grew rapidly because of the extra food, the amount of food per human in these communities didn't increase because as the population goes up with a fixed amount of food, and probably actually decreased in time. So it's a really interesting take on that whole thing of the agricultural revolution. And he takes a similar dispassionate and logical and interesting view of other stages of our development, such as the development of hierarchical societies, religion, writing, trade, and money. He talks about the one true advantage of Homo sapiens as being the ability for us to invent fiction, to invent and then deal with imaginary concepts, such as community, kingship, and gods. And his chapter on the invention of the imaginary concept of money is particularly fascinating. So as I say, I haven't quite finished the book, but it's already been a really, really interesting read, and I strongly recommend it to you.
I've got that book on my to-be-read list, wherever it is on the list. It's a fair way down, but yes, I have heard about it, and it's one that I have heard very good things about. I'd ask you a question, though. Does he have anything to say about the domestication of other animals, and I mean in particular domestication of dogs? Does he bring that up as a...
No, I don't think so. He doesn't mention dogs specifically, no.
There's a theory that... there's a lot of theories, and most of these you basically can't prove, but they're just mostly interesting thought pieces. There's a theory, for example, that one of the things that differentiated Homo sapiens from the Neanderthal was that Neanderthal didn't have any whites in its eyes. Now, you might think, so what does that matter? Well, when it comes down to the situation where you domesticate a dog, and dogs, when they are domesticated, will look to the master and then can understand where the master's pointing or looking. And as a non-verbal communication, if the human Homo sapien, looks at a dog and then looks ahead, the dog will follow the person's gaze because it can see that the pupils and irises have moved inside the white of the eye and are looking somewhere different, whereas the Neanderthal couldn't. Now, I don't know whether this is just a piece of mumbo-jumbo crap.
How do we know what Neanderthal eyes were like?
Good question. That's a good assumption to which I do not have a good answer. But what it comes down to is that if that is true, that is a very interesting interesting theory. There was a book a while back which I've tried to track down. It was one of those articles that are read on, you know, either The Guardian or NPR or Smithsonian or one of those interesting magazines somewhere on the internet that deals with scientific, popular science, if you like, in this instance, where they try to explain a particular theory and put it out to people for a general readership, such as me, to be able to explain to them what the new research is doing. And this person has written a book whose name I can't remember, the title I can't remember, but as much as I've tried to track it down, I can't find it. And every now and again I find it, I go, oh yeah, that's right, I must remember that, and I forget it again, about this idea that humans and domesticating wolves to become dogs work for both of them.
I think that it certainly was an important stage, but yeah, no, Harari doesn't talk about that specifically.
Okay. No, that's okay though, but I do like the idea that it was wheat that domesticated humans.
Yeah,
around
I think
the
that's
other
very
around.
Clever.
I think that's it's a very, very interesting and convincing thought. I think that's great.
Yeah.
I like that sort of stuff. If you can sort of turn things upside down and get people thinking about it, the more they argue and scream about it, the more chance you've got of getting a bit more informed debate.
Sure. Yeah.
And it's not a matter of I don't believe that this happens. It's just a matter of, well, convince me by argument that it isn't true. And then we can have a discussion about it. And that's what that's what's good about these sorts of things. And the more theories you have about it where you're willing to discuss them in an articulate and a regulated and comprehensive manner, you'll get a better result out of things in the end. And that's what's good. Right, moving on from the distant past to the distant future. And I've also read Foundation, the first of the Isaac Asimov's Foundation series, which was originally published in 1951. Now, the reason why I've decided to go back and read this particular book, David, is that there has been a television series made of the first book, at least, and I believe they're going to be making them of the next two, or if not more, in the series. And that is going to be released sometime in mid-late September.
Yeah.
So I thought I'd best go back and read Foundation, which I haven't read in, I don't know, 30, 40 years. I reckon I probably read it in my teens, and that was about it. So this is the first of these, followed by Foundation and Empire and Second Foundation in the original trilogy. But then Asimov later on tried to integrate it in with his robot stories and everything else. So it becomes a bit of a mishmash. I don't know where it all goes after that. But let's just look at these three in particular, but this first one. Now, this has long been considered one of the greatest SF series of all time. So to give you a background, the novel is set about 10,000 years in the future when mankind has spread all the way right across the galaxy and has built up a galactic empire. Now, that galactic empire is predicted to collapse by a person by the name of Harry Seldon, who's a psychohistorian. Psychohistory is the study of history and the psychology of large groups of people that and how they meld together and basically the cycles they go through. Seldon notes that the galactic empire is going to collapse and that if it continues on the way that it is, the 10,000 year era of peace, 10 or 12,000 year era of peace, will be followed by 30,000 years of war and anarchy. And he predicts that the only way for the galaxy to get over this 30,000 years is to set up two foundations at opposite ends of the galaxy as a last bastion of piece of knowledge. Now, of course, the powers that be in the Galactic Empire don't like this, and they say that you can't say that we're going to collapse. That's a terrible thing to say. You're going to incite riots and ill feeling amongst the people, so we're going to arrest you and possibly execute you. Yeah, that's a good way to stop things from happening, isn't it? We've heard that before. Now, this series is based on the fall of the Roman Empire, with the foundation taking place, part of the Irish monasteries that basically found themselves at the edge of the Roman Empire, right on the far western side of Ireland. They were so far away that nobody really bothered about them terribly much, but they were the last bastions of literature and knowledge in the whole of Europe during the Middle Ages. And it was only after things settled down that the information started to eke out from there and spread its way back again across through Ireland, Great Britain and Europe. The Foundation novel is told in a series of novellas, each set just before predicted crises that Harry Seldon has come up with and says in 50 years' time this is going to happen, and then 25 years' time after that this is going to happen, and so on. And he keeps on making appearances in what's referred to as a time vault, so that at certain times, 70 years down the track, he basically makes an appearance and gives a sort of a small lecture, which seems to last about 3 minutes, and then he's gone. And you think, okay, doesn't really say anything very much, but people sort of say, yes, I understand exactly what he's talking about. This is the only way we can go about doing it. So it's a peculiar book from that instance, because it's episodic. You don't really get a bit of a view about who the characters are, because it's hard to relate to any of them. And anyway, this is written by Isaac Asimov, so the characters are pretty much subservient to the plot ideas, and the plot and the ideas in the whole story are there really is just mouthpieces for what Asimov wants to say. You barely can name any of them outside Harry Seldon, and you wouldn't be able to describe any of them as being any different from any of the others. There's a grand total I counted of two women in the whole book. One of them is a slave girl who basically is there to show off a little bit of a trinket, and one's the wife of an ambassador. That's it. Mm-hmm. All the rest of them are men, and all the rest of them give you the impression of sort of white, middle-aged, patrician, standard sort of stuff that Asimov thought they would be. Oh, and by the way, they still smoke. They smoke all the way through. Guys are riding cigars everywhere. They're smoking in spaceships. They're smoking around all over the place. It's quite peculiar when you look back on some of the 1950s SF and you think, did they really think they were going to be smoking on spaceships? I know they hadn't stopped smoking on, well, they didn't stop smoking on planes until the late 80s, but even so, you would have thought something would have changed, wouldn't you?
You would have thought so, yeah.
Anyway, look, it's an interesting story. It's one of those ones I think that if you want to be reasonably knowledgeable about the science fiction field, this is one of those ones I think you should read. And I don't mean to say that we should build up a canon of science fiction works that have to fit into it. If I was, I would say that this probably needs to be in it, just to give you the background about what type of things were happening in the 1950s, about how American science fiction thought of galactic empires and what they did. It's an interesting idea. Asimov is not a great writer by any stretch of the imagination. There is no inner life to any of these at all.
No, oh dear. Yeah.
Characters, not a bit. They hide things from you by not telling you stuff and then tell you later. But there's no inner life. They are just ciphers for the ideas that he wants to put across. If you keep that in mind, you can read it and go, yeah, okay, glad I read it, have a look at it. Hopefully the TV series will be better.
Well, it'd be interesting to see how the TV series handles all that, yeah.
Well, it would, and that's really the reason why I read it in this instance, yeah.
I'm wondering whether the TV series will also take into account the prequels and things that were written by Greg Bear and Gregory Benford. Greg Bear and David Brin, I think, wrote to series of sequels or prequels, I'm not sure. I've never read those.
From what I've seen, they're basically starting off with this novel.
Okay.
So Harry Seldon is really the one that you have to be dealing with. Now, I don't think, maybe they've taken some bits from the earlier parts. What we'll have to do is watch the TV series and report.
Indeed we will, indeed we will. All right, the last book I'm going to talk about, it's the last one of the day, We've been going for a little while. Well, this is very appropriate, really. It's called The End of the Day by Claire North. Now, we've talked about the novels of Claire North on the podcast before, such as The First 15 Lives of Harry August and The Sudden Appearance of Hope and so on. And they're all very interesting in various ways. But this one takes yet another tack. This novel, the novel starts with a short passage in which somebody, we don't know who it is clearly preparing to commit suicide by taking an overdose of pills. They're sitting there in a hotel room counting out the pills, ready to start taking them. And then we suddenly shift. In the second chapter, we're introduced to Charlie. And Charlie is an Englishman in his 30s, and he's got a job, which involves a lot of travel. It's all run out of an office in Milton Keynes in the United Kingdom. He himself was born in Birmingham, so nothing unusual about any of that. Except that Charlie's job is being the harbinger of death. He's a perfectly normal, ordinary human being. It's just that his job is being the harbinger of death. And his ultimate boss is, well, death himself. Or herself, depending on how you see death. Different people see death in different ways. In fact, everyone sees death in their own way. Now, Charlie goes to where he's told to by Milton Keynes, who make all the travel arrangements, make sure that he has passports and visas and travel insurance, all the usual sort of thing. And what he does isn't a secret. He's free to tell people he meets and his girlfriend, he gets a girlfriend eventually, about his job. And though it sometimes takes them a while to cotton on, you know, your job is the harbinger of death. Okay. They eventually nod and accept it. It's just a job. And what does the job entail? Well, it isn't sent to everyone, despite what the cover of the book would have you believe. Death directs Charlie, generally through Milton Keynes, death directs Charlie to go to and see selected individuals, usually carrying some sort of gift, chosen by death, but bought by Charlie, who has to submit invoices of his expenses to Milton Keynes. Sometimes Charlie is sent as a courtesy when someone or something significant is dying, and sometimes he's sent as a warning. He never knows quite which. Death says that he used to send ravens and other omens as warnings, but people stop paying attention, but they pay more attention to a human being. Now, at the start of the book, when Charlie's only been in the new job for a week, we accompany him as he visits a dying old woman in Peru. She's the last speaker of a native language, and so Charlie is sent to honour her, and he brings her a bottle of whiskey, good whiskey, which is what death directed him to take. So he stays and he chats with her and they drink the whiskey and he tells her about a girl he's interested in, but he's never quite had the words to talk to. And then when the bottle's empty, he gets up and leaves. And death will visit the old lady soon enough. Does it all sound comic, amusing? But it's not. Let me tell you, it's not. There is admittedly this faintly absurdist, humorous tinge to all of Charlie's dealings with the head office. And we also get to meet the harbingers of war, of pestilence, of famine, as well as their bosses. So there's a slight similarity to, you know, the book by Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett, Good Omens, in that the four horsemen of the apocalypse appear as characters. But the book as a whole isn't at all comic. It's sad. It's melancholy. It's all about death, after all. And sometimes it becomes very grim indeed. And while death, him or herself, may be a personification of an abstract concept, Charlie, as I've said, is fully human. And it's this human response which death is keen to provide to certain individuals before their death, and why he sends his harbinger. And Charlie's a good, kind man with a number of instances where he extends help to others beyond the requirements of the job. But Charlie, being human, eventually starts to struggle emotionally with the burden of the job. The job isn't easy. Early on, Charlie has to trek for days across Greenland in search of an old man, a professor, and he's accompanied by a guide. They eventually find the old man on the ice of a glacier. The old man's unconscious and badly frostbitten, and they have to drag him off the ice. And when he recovers and Charlie hands over Death's gift, which is a container of tea, after they brew and drink the tea, the old man gets up, staggers away, and runs across the ice, and then throws himself into a crevasse, commits suicide. Only then do we discover that Charlie's guide was the old man's estranged son. And here we're witnessing not just the death of the old man, but because Charlie, in this long journey, has been observing the changes caused by climate change, global warming, we're also witnessing the end of the world, or a world at least, or a foreshadowing of that. And on the ice, Charlie sees, for the first time, sees Death himself riding a pale horse. Charlie's job isn't without its dangers, both physical and mental. In Syria, he spends a long time with the commander of a group of rebels and comes close to being blown up, and he witnesses the grisly, very grisly, aftermath of a massacre of civilians. In Belarus, the underlings of a dying old man who is the head of a mafia-style organization try to force Charlie to negotiate with Death on their behalf. How much do I buy him off? What will it take? And Charlie protests that it doesn't work like that. You know, he has no way of getting Death to change his mind. But they don't believe him, and they beat him up badly, and they hold a gun to his head saying they'll kill him unless he rings his boss. So Charlie rings the number he's been given and eventually gets through to Death, who asks him about what's going on. Death is displeased. This is not something you want, as the gangsters quickly find out. Anyway, towards the end, it's all getting too much for poor Charlie, and we realise that it's he who we saw in the opening chapter counting up the pills. And he takes the first pill, and then there's a knock on the door. So, look, as I say, the book's mostly melancholy, and it's often grim, but it's ultimately a celebration of life, really, and not of death, of the human rather than the supernatural. And Charlie represents every one of us who know that one day we must die, but we have to go on living as best we can. The living is what it's all about. So this is rather different from the other books I've read by Claire North, but I thought it was very worthwhile. It's interesting, very thought-provoking. She's a very, very interesting writer, I would say. Yeah, so that was good. I'm looking forward to reading more of her work.
All right, that sounds good. She has another one coming out later this year.
I have a copy already. It is called Notes from the Burning Age.
Oh, it's out already, is it?
It's on my shelf. I'm about to read it.
Okay, good. Okay, well, we should basically both get to that one maybe and have a look at it.
Indeed.
All right, David, I think we're done for the week.
I think we probably are.
We'll meet again in a couple of weeks when, as we said at the beginning of this little program, we'll be dealing with the short stories on the 2020 Hugo Ballot. Six of them. Be easier to read than the novelettes.
A bit shorter anyway, at least.
A bit shorter, yes, yes. Yes, I think they might, stories inside the short story set will probably be more to short story ideal, really, hopefully. We'll keep our fingers crossed. I haven't read any of them yet, and we'll do so in the next fortnight. And we shall discuss them then.
Indeed.
All right, thank you, David.
Okay. No worries. We'll see you then.
All right, see you later on. Bye.
Bye.